Well, good evening.
Evening.
It's hard to compete with a good meal and a good fellowship, but here I am and looking forward to bringing God's Word to you. Before we get started, I've got a couple things I want to do. One's pray, but first I'll give you a disclaimer, or maybe it's a confession. I'm not sure which, but a portion of what I'm bringing tonight comes out of a book called Masculine Mandate by Richard Phillips. Chapter 3. So if you go read that chapter, or maybe even more so, if you read the discussion questions at the end of the book, you'll see some striking similarities in a few places. So, you know, that's kind of, I work in the nuclear business. That's one of our favorite sayings. We cooperate a lot in the nuclear business. We share things with other plants. So the best way to get anything is to steal it with pride. So that's a little bit what I did there tonight. So let's open up with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you for the chance to fellowship around your word tonight in many ways, times of conversation and encouragement that at least I heard at the table I was at. I thank you for that. Lord, I thank you for what you bring to us so that we can know the truths, and these truths can come into our lives and enrich us so deeply and prepare us to serve you and honor you and glorify your name. That's what we want to do tonight. I particularly pray that selfishly you would give me a very clear head, that I could bring what you've given me to bring with clarity and with correctness. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So, how many of you, who in here either went to school or worked today? And the rest of you wish you did? Anyway, there weren't very many in the rest of you. So, I have a topic that I think is at least relevant. So, why'd you go to work? I mean, why do we do that? Hey, that one works. Wife kicked me out of the house. But you know, why do we go to work? Well, you know, there's a popular saying out in the world, I owe, so off to work I go. Is that what it's all about? Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, we do go to work so that we can provide for our families. I mean, Dave brought us a message on providing some time back. And so, you know, it would be difficult, impossible for almost everybody I know to provide for their family if they didn't work. So, you know, that is a part of it, and it's reasonable. You know, but there's more to it than that. And we're going to find out a little bit about some of that tonight. If you get in a conversation with a group of men, particularly ones that don't know each other very well, a lot of things come to the conversation very well. Hi, what's your name? And, you know, you get names around. And then, at least when I go to nuclear plants and so on, usually sports teams get involved for a few minutes. Kind of had an interesting thing today. I was in a meeting. There was about 220 of us, I'd guess, in the room. And it was a pretty serious meeting. There was a lot going on. It was pretty important stuff to Wolf Creek and where we're going with the future and a few things. And our CEO, our chief executive officer, was leading the conclusion of the meeting. And he was trying to move us back to the real world and remembering we had a life and Friday's not supposed to be a work day, but here we all were there. And he says, so what's going on in the world? Who's KU play? And there was this pause for a while. You know, with 200 plus people in the room around here, there's got to be at least one KU fan in the room, right? Well, I don't know, because the only thing that came out was, after a long pause, who cares? Everybody laughed and we left. So, I don't know. But anyway, I'm serious. That's exactly the way it went. I was a little bit surprised, but that's kind of how it went. But, you know, by the time you get past the weather and the sports, I mean, when you get to know somebody, if you're in a conversation of men, you go, well what do you do? I mean, even when I go to a meeting at nuclear plants, well, what's your role in the plant? You know, we know we work at nuclear plants. We know we're all goofy in the same way. So, but it's still what's your responsibilities when we talk about work? Why is work so central to our lives? Do you ever think about that? I mean, really, we talk about it all the time. A lot of the times we're talking about, boy, it's a tough job today. You know, usually, most of the time, if you get outside of the workspace and you talk about things, I know I do, it's, I'm having a tough time at work. That's what I talk about. But it's there. You know, one passage, we ought to go over there, Genesis 3. This is one that a lot of people will talk about when they talk about work. Genesis 3. Very familiar to most of you, probably. We're going to look at verses 17 through 19. So, a little bit of history. God made the world. We know that. Shortly after that, there's not a whole lot of other history given there. Man and his wife, we give the wife credit for starting the ball rolling, but man was right there with her and didn't hesitate a second. They sin. And then you get a curse, right? Well, this is a part of the curse. Then to Adam, he said, God, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. So here's the curse. A lot of times we talk about the curse. We talk about, man, work's tough. Well, yeah, that's part of our curse. And it is. Not only does man have to work hard because of the curse to make it all work, but, you know, before the fall of man's sin, you know, the ground grew things. But after he sinned, not only does he have to work hard to get things to grow and to keep it going, but he's got to deal with things growing that weren't a problem before. He's got thorns and thistles and weeds. So you go out and work and you till the ground, and not only do you get the plants you wanted, but you get weeds. And, you know, there's whole industries in our world that are geared around trying to keep the weeds out of our world enough that we can be satisfied. And if you're like me and you try to keep the weeds under control somewhere, you're still never satisfied. You put all the chemicals on, you do all the work, and you go, okay, I've got that mat down now. It's not going to grow here. Oh, no, yeah, it will. It sure does, at least for my house. So, you know, from the curse, we could say, that's why we work. But that would be false. Turn back a couple chapters to Genesis 1. We'll see if I wrote down the right verses here. Here's what God said to man before the fall. God, verse 28 is where I'm starting. God blessed them, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And here's where the work starts in. And subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Now, subduing the earth, if we were to, now I realize it's fall, so we've got weeds, but imagine there's no weeds and no plants you don't want, and say, okay, it's you and your wife, go out and subdue the earth, take care of it. Think that'd be a massive task? You know, I don't care if there aren't any weeds. He didn't give them a small job. So God gave them work. Go on down to the last verse. This is after he gave them work. God saw all that he had made. He'd just given this work assignment to Adam. And behold, it was very good. So work isn't a curse. We were made for work. That's a part of what we were created for. It fits us. It's a part of who we are. And because of the fall, we have to work hard. As a matter of fact, if we don't work hard, our families suffer. 2 Thessalonians 3:10, we want to put work in perspective. Here's what Paul had to say about work. If I can get my fingers to do the right turning here. So I get in 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Is not the right verse. Well, I missed it. What's that? Oh, no, I'm in 1 Thessalonians. The verse might be right, but I can't turn to the right page. There we go. 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Thank you for your help. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. So Paul makes it pretty clear that for those that can, I mean, I don't think he's trying to address people that really, truly are disabled and can't work. But for those that can work, if they don't work, don't bother feeding them. I mean, it's just a part of our responsibility to do that and to take care of ourselves and our families with regard to caring for work. And a few other good words about work. Proverbs 10:4. Proverbs 10:4 says, Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. In other words, if you're slothful in your work, if you're lazy, if you just kind of halfway go at it, expect halfway results. You're going to be poor. But if you want to have enough to take care of yourself and your family, and this even says rich, that's what the diligent worker gets as a result of his labors. You could also look at chapter 12, just a couple over, verse 27, and you'd see this said about work. A lazy man does not roast his prey, but the precious possession of a man is diligence. What does it mean, a lazy man doesn't roast his prey? Why doesn't he roast his prey? He doesn't have any. He came up short because he was too lazy to go out and kill something, bring it home, and eat it. So that's kind of where he's at. So we either work hard or our families suffer. We know that. That's just the law of effect in this world. You try to make it through without working. There might be some programs that help you out a little bit, but don't expect to live very high on the hog. And it's just a part of how it is. We know that if we want to get somewhere, we're going to be working. So work's good. We were made for work. God had a plan for work. He created us to have this work in our lives. So I would contend to you, I would offer this argument then, when work is in its proper place in our lives, that's actually a form of worship. Think about that a minute. Now, when we think about worship correctly, the best form of worship, the worship at its best, is when we are usually in a public setting with our full attention devoted to God, recognizing who He is, and we are directing our praise and admiration for Him and publicly saying He's really the God He claimed to be, and extolling His virtues and sending our appreciation to God in the forms of song and prayer and praise. And that's what the best praise is. But I also tell you that the world is full of counterfeit ways to get places or get things or to satisfy the basic needs and desires that God put in our lives. And when you look at that, you can see the world's counterfeit ways at work. The easy one to talk about in today's world is relationships. God created us, not 100% of us, but most of us as men, God intended us to have a relationship with a woman who would be a wife and a spouse to us, and that relationship would have multifaceted aspects to it. There would be an emotional component. There would be a service component. There would be a sacrifice component. There would be a physical component. And when we follow God's plan that way, we find satisfaction in a way that you won't find any other way. That's how He made us. It's in the right spot. But what does the world do? They go for all kinds of counterfeit ways to fulfill those needs. And that's dishonoring to God. It's against God. But for the person who pursues it in God's way, lets the world see. I mean, you're worshiping God. You're showing that you believe that the plan and direction that God gave you for that kind of a relationship is the path to take, and you're doing it. It honors God to do that. That's a kind of worship. So when we put work, as we were created for, in the right perspective, in the right place, in the right order, when it's in alignment with what God intended in our lives, it's a form of worship in a way. So that's what I would contend to you. But like most everything in the world, and we just talked about one situation, here's work that can be worship for us, but boy, can we pervert it in all kinds of other ways. And then it becomes sin, and it becomes egregious to God. It's against our testimony of who God is. Some of these I've got written down, so I don't have to do all the turning, but I'll give you a second if you want to. Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 9, written by a man named Solomon. Who was Solomon? Well, he was King David's son. He inherited the throne from his dad at a young age. And he wrote some books. When he was young, as this new king, God offered to him to give him something to help him in his kingly role. And Solomon said, I want wisdom. And God gave it to him. There was none in the world as wise as Solomon. And that's where we got the book of Proverbs we were reading from earlier. That's a part of his sayings about wisdom, about how life generally is based on his wisdom. Well, in this case, we're going to look at a book called Ecclesiastes, which was Solomon's reflection on things about life. And in these first 9 verses, you're going to hear him talk about work. And this is what he's going to say. These are the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Meaningless, meaningless. Vanities of vanities. All is vanity. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? What's it good for? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea's not full. The place where the rivers flow, they flow there again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. And it goes on. What's Solomon kind of a moodsy in here? He's had a bad day. He's had a bad life. I mean, I don't want to go so far as to bring too negative a comment about his life, but what he's looking at all of his years and saying, what good's work do? The more I work, things are still the same. I haven't made a difference. The sun was coming up over there before I started, and it still does the same thing. It rises, it sets. Everything's still the same. The river runs to the sea and doesn't even fill up. So who am I? How's this work going to be meaningful? Kind of a depressing thought. And Solomon did a lot of work. Solomon built the temple. God didn't let David build the first temple because David had been too involved in bloody wars. But he granted to David that his son Solomon build the temple. So here's the guy that built the temple going, I'm not even making a difference. It's a waste of time. And he built lots of other things. Building was the order of the day in Israel. I don't know if it would be fair or right to call them the equivalent of a superpower of their day, but they were definitely powerful militarily. They had the economic engine. They had the building projects. They had this wise king that the whole world was coming to hear from. They were on top of it. And Solomon was the one running it all. And he says, oh, it's just a big waste of time. How do you suppose that attitude would help out your workplace? Would you like to have this guy around? I remember, I'm going to be very careful here. I think I'm all right. I remember years ago when I first went to, on night shift at INC, Instrumentation and Control. That's where I worked the first few years I was at Wolf Creek. That was okay, but the second time they changed who my shift buddy was. They put two of us on round-the-clock kinds of shift work for a few weeks, and then we'd roll out of that for a few weeks. And my supervisor came to me and warned me. He says, you're going to pay attention. I go, okay. I mean, I was kind of new and green, so I was used to people telling me and coaching me about, you know, that's just down to two of us to do whatever the control room needed and deal with the instrumentation and the control circuitry and all that. And I thought he was going to give me some technical advice because of all the responsibility I was going to carry as this newer technician in the shop. He said, your shift partner, and of course he used his name, has a really bad attitude. And he's so negative, it's hard to work with him very much without getting that same attitude. Well, I think Solomon here was a lot worse than that guy was, as bad as he truly was. And so, you know, if you don't have work in the right perspective, if you have an attitude about your work, I mean, I'll bet you either you have or you know somebody who has developed this kind of an attitude for a while in the workplace. And now that I do a little supervision once in a while in my job, these folks are killers. They will ruin a workplace in a minute. You know, all of a sudden everybody's complaining. Nothing's right. Management's all stupid. Which might be true, but you don't have to say it out loud. Not when I'm around. But anyway, you know, it's really hard to take a work group somewhere when you got one of these attitudes in there. Your only hope is the rest of the people get tired of them and kind of ostracize them. Or, I mean, you can talk to them, but of course, when you talk to somebody like this, well, they already knew you were stupid, so they're not going to pay any attention to you. So anyway, that it's just really hard. And even when a person recognizes that in themselves and wants to turn around, it's tough. But we'll deal with that in a little later. So that's one thing that can take you wrong in a workplace and make it perverted. Another one's pride. Romans 12:3 is where we're going to talk about. Another way to pervert work in your life. I don't have to turn to it. I've got it written right here. I'll quit trying that. Romans 12:3. Here's an admonition from Paul that can explain the problem with pride in the workplace. For through the grace given me, I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. Is it tempting in the workplace to, I don't know if you think of yourself more highly than you ought, but to project that to others? I mean, get in a setting. I remember an Andy Griffith show years ago where Andy was invited, his son was over to play with somebody, and he was invited to this group, and they're all pretty high-fluting businessmen, and his son was a little embarrassed that his dad was just a lowly sheriff. And Andy tried to kind of support that by just kind of being quiet and putting on a few airs. Didn't work out so well. Well, you know, I see that same thing. I go to a nuclear plant. Here we all are, nuclear training people sitting around a table, introducing yourselves, and the first one says, well, I'm a mechanical instructor, and the next says, well, I'm a maintenance supervisor or whatever, and somebody else says, well, I'm a superintendent, and somebody else says, well, I'm manager. And, you know, even though you're not going to change your title for that, you know, afterwards people get to talk about, well, so what's a superintendent do at your plant? Well, so then you have to explain, well, you know, a supervisor's an answer to me, and I'm responsible for, you know. And, you know, it's kind of this, okay, what's the order here? And doesn't that happen when you're meeting somebody new? I mean, you want to be respected for what you do. It's a big part of your life. It's real tempting to make the most of it. That's a nice way of saying what I should have said, okay? So, you know, pride can be a problem in the workplace. You can make it about who you are and what people, how important people think you are, how skilled people think you are. I'm not taking anything away from doing a good job in the workplace and seeing that as a good thing, and we'll come back to that too. Another one is that can happen as a result of work is you can get trapped in a love of riches and money. 1 Timothy 6, 9, and 10 is where we're going to turn to for that one. I mean, you get in the workplace and, you know, as you escalate through the years, statistically, age 50 to 60 is your best earning years. So for those of you that, you know, kind of think you're 35 and kind of passing your peak, now you're at least in earning potential. You're probably not even getting warmed up yet. But when you get there, it's real easy to start measuring your worth that way. By that, I mean self-worth, self-opinion. This is a temptation in how you approach work as it becomes about money. Here's what 1 Timothy 6, 9, and 10 says. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Yeah, it happens, doesn't it? It really does. You get some money and you get focused on money. And so now all of a sudden, you know, work gets to be too important. And you start thinking about, well, you know, I need to go to work. It's a double time day. Or I need to get out there and sell another 1,000 because my commission will be this much. And it really starts to get a money focus when you start feeling like, hey, you know, I really can earn something, whether it's at 25 or 55. Those kinds of things can really be a temptation and a trap. It's kind of fun to get, instead of going backwards every month, you go ahead for a while. I mean, it feels good. And that's not a bad thing, but when the focus turns to how big a pile can I get, then you got a problem. And it's not about how big the pile gets. I'm not saying it's wrong to make some money, but is that the focus? Is that why you're doing it? Is that what's really important in your life? And that can lead to bad decisions. You can go, well, I could make a lot more if I'd kind of cut a corner here. And it just can be a bad thing. Let's go on and talk to another one that's kind of related to it, and then we'll pull these last three together. You can actually wind up in idolatry. 1 John 2, 15 and 16. All of these things are in a form of idolatry. But this points it a little more tightly. And many of you know these verses. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from God, but is from the world. And it's easy to want things, toys or cool, till you figure out they own you instead of you owning them. I mean, I have been there very recently. I'm trying to get out from under it. But I've had enough toys, and I'm not going to make you the list because I'd be embarrassed. It's not important. But I've had enough toys. I spent all my time fixing toys. I mean, particularly if I'd go back about 10 years or so, when I also had two kids in the house, and they were starting to accumulate a few toys. And you know who fixes their toys? But anyway, you know, when we had four cars, because two kids and mom and dad, and I'd be embarrassed to say we might have had five. We might have had the Suburban then to pull the boat around, too. Oh, and the boat. Well, anyway, we won't go into all that. But, you know, you get that stuff around, and you find out that, you know, you go through a lot of oil doing oil changes. And when things break down, you know, it's you either pay a lot of money to get them fixed, or being my world before Wolf Creek was fixing airplanes, I fix things, and so I fix it myself. Those things own you, but it takes you a while to figure that out, and some people never do. But the trap here is you start loving those things of the world. And so if you go back and pull those three together, you get prideful about who you are, how good the job's going, how much responsibility you've got. You can start loving the money, and then you can start being enticed by those worldly things. Lust of the flesh, there's a word there in it, lust of the flesh. Lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life. And you know, you get to start feeling important and powerful, and other people like your toys. And the next thing you know, I mean, how many men have wound up in that part of their life when things are going really well for the first time, and the next thing you know, you hear they're having a divorce because they got hooked up with some woman at work? They got so wrapped up in their work that they messed it up. It's real easy in this period to get so involved in the work life that you stay there more than you should. Not because there's always more work to do. Sometimes just because it's fun, because of the praise you get, or maybe the illicit relationship I talked about a minute ago. Or frankly, it's just more fun than being home because things go right there for you at home. You got a challenge. So you start neglecting raising kids and tending to your wife. I mean, that can happen as a result of having work out of place in your life. It can get you there. Here's another one. Catch up in sin. 1 Corinthians 15:33. This is the last one on this list. You can make this list all day long, by the way. I'm just going to give you these and quit. We're going to go to the other side of the coin here. But 1 Corinthians 15:33. And can this happen at work? Be not deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Who do you hang out with at work? Now, for those of us that work in the real world, and that's almost all of us here, you're not going to avoid a little bit of bad company at work, are you? So you need a strategy on how you're going to handle that and honor them, be a good testimony to them, let Christ be seen, but yet not be in a situation where your morals get corrupted. I'll tell you a story about a guy who lacked Christ, as far as I know, and still does. I've lost track of him since my college days. But when I was in high school, there was a real straight-laced guy. As far as I know, he never drank anything anytime. And I was just like him in that sense. Now, we were different in most every other way. But we made great college roommates. In my freshman year of college, we were roommates. And that was cool. We didn't drink, we didn't like to drink, and we were the only dry dorm wing. There was one, every wing in every dorm at K-State's campus got to vote on rules. And one of the ones you could vote on is whether or not you allowed alcohol on your floor. Another one was whether or not you allowed women on your floor. And we voted both of those no. Now, there's a setup here. When K-State put us in dorms in the 70s, 76 was my year there, the fall of 75 and then 76, they did their housing by, you filled out a questionnaire. So they tried to put people with similar sleeping patterns and whatever in similar parts of the campus. And so I think, anybody that said no to alcohol, I think the few of us that there were got put in that wing. But so we were in a dry wing. And this roommate of mine was an engineering student, as I was then. I didn't complete my engineering degree, but he did very well academically. He got zapped up by a company called Farmland Industries. There'll be a bunch of people here who know who that is. And they used him as an engineer. And I don't know what his job was at first, but they found out he was able to be very personable and handle significant kinds of contractual issues for Farmland Industries. So shortly after being with him, he was no longer functioning as an engineer. He was actually buying crude oil or some derivative thereof for Farmland Industries. And he was also responsible for helping contract that oil to be refined so that they could sell it through their system. And one of the requirements for that, and I didn't tell you, by the way, that he picked out his sweetheart when we were juniors in high school from another school close by, and she was a real sweetheart. Everything that anybody would have wanted in a girl, she was. Very nice young lady, very self-controlled, very, very attractive, and he managed to capture her. And they became married, I think, about our junior year in college. He and I kind of drifted apart when I went to the Christian college. He was busy with engineering, and I was busy with my stuff. But his family lived just a mile up the road back in our little town. We were in the country, but north of our little town. And so I would keep up with this friend of mine through my parents. They'd tell me, because they, matter of fact, that family still rents some of my dad's ground. But they would tell me what was going on with him. And you know, about 4 years after he graduated, because he had to wine and dine these guys, and he was always on the road, and I don't know the whole story, but I know he was a divorced alcoholic. Bad company corrupts good morals. Watch out what you get yourself involved with on the job. Seriously, it'll get you there. So we talked about these bad things. We got to turn the corner, spent too long on them. What does it look like when work has its proper place in our lives? That's a good question. We've already covered the fact that we're not supposed to love the world nor the things in the world, but that's only half of the equation. The other half is found when Jesus was asked a question. Matthew 22, we're going to start out reading 34 through 38, and then we'll add a couple more verses on the end of that. Going to be very familiar to some of you. We put a big emphasis on that here just a few years ago. This is the greatest of the commandments. Even though it was intended to be a trap question, Jesus answered it well. Here's what it says. But when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they were all trying to trap Jesus, these two groups, they gathered themselves together. One of them, a lawyer, they put up their bright guy, asked him a question. And he knew he was safe because nobody had else been able to answer this question. They've been trying to answer it themselves for years. But here was the question, testing him, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in all the law? And he said to him, Jesus returning this answer, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and foremost commandment. You know that your work can be aligned with that love? What does it look like when your work is aligned with that love for your God and your service to the Lord Jesus Christ? Well, it's really pretty straightforward. Our behavior will honor God. The thoughts of our heart will honor God. We'll be able to go to work with integrity. We won't have to be outside of truth-telling and outside of those things that anyone would say were full of integrity. Honesty and, frankly, even obedience. You know, we'll be able to go to work and obey God. That's what it amounts to. Pretty straightforward, simple stuff. But you can't miss the fact that it comes, it's not I am just determined to follow all these rules. It comes out of what's in your heart. And so if you want to have the right understanding of what work is supposed to be like, if you want to be prepared to go into the workplace, you've got to start by fostering, by encouraging, by making your heart a fertile place for loving the Lord your God with everything you are. Very intentional. Here's the rest of that answer as well, though. When we look at verses 39 and 40, the second is like it. He doesn't just answer the first question. He gives him a knockout punch by telling, I'll give you number two as well. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. So love your neighbor as yourself. The idea here is service. And you know, most of us in our jobs, even many worldly jobs, most of us even with that are worldly by nature, serve in our jobs. First of all, by working, we provide for a family. We're serving. But you can go beyond that. Almost every job is either providing a service, like medical services, hauling trash, even cleaning gutters, whatever. We do a service. Or we make goods for our community, maybe even for the world. We might be involved with defending our country. We might be involved in law enforcement. I mean, any job you go to, frankly, is some sort of a service, or nobody's going to be willing to pay you to keep doing it. So by nature, work is service. But this comes out of our heart because we see those folks that we're serving. When we're making the widgets, we're making them recognizing this is good for the world. And frankly, I'm glad for this. Wolf Creek is one of those companies that we talk about that a lot. Even though it's a worldly company, it's not a Christian company by any stretch. But we recognize we provide a service, and we recognize that if we don't make electricity in a manner where the public's happy to have us there, we won't be there. And so we're very mindful of that. Well, that's fine, but as believers, we can emphasize that in our living. There's another part of it that really, I think, is the key. And so I'm going to talk less about what it means to understand how to put work in the right perspective in your life, less words, but far more significance. Look back again at Ecclesiastes. But this time, let's look at chapter 5. Remember that guy Solomon and how depressed he was about his work? He wasn't done writing about work. He kind of takes a full journey in the book of Ecclesiastes on a number of topics, and this is one of them. And here's what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20. Here's this wise man looking back on his life and back on what he's done and his kingly role, and he says, "Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting: to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart." Sound like the same guy? I mean, this sounds like somebody totally different. He's talking about work. And how's he viewing it? He's saying it's such a reward, you won't even think about how fast the years are going because it's just so great. What happened to Solomon? How could he move from the attitude that he had, which, by the way, we're telling you now what the key is, if you struggle with your attitude at work, and I would dare say all of us do at one time or another. What's the key? What happened to Solomon? What fixed him? What's right here in what we just read? He's telling us, just maybe not as directly as we might think. What he's telling us is that this is a gift of God. He's looking at it in a whole different way. First, when we saw Ecclesiastes 1, Solomon was looking at work saying he tried to impress himself with what he could accomplish. He said, "Here's the work in my hands. I'm doing all this stuff, but things remain the same." What he's recognizing is he's not the one that makes a difference, either in his own life to impress himself. This is the man that built the temple. And it didn't mean anything because he was working out of who he was, trying to impress himself and probably the world. But when he gets to the end of it and looks and says, and looks at it through the fact that this is a gift from God, he says, "You know, this is really pretty good. God really gave me a great thing. He not only let me do this work, but he lets me have the benefit of living out of the wealth it creates and having dominion over that, eating from it. The work is fun when you see it as a gift from God. The work is meaningful. It has some value. And you know, you've experienced it to an extent. You've looked back on a job well done and said, that was good. And that is a God-given feeling. God made us to work. And Solomon's just recognized, this is what God made me for. He finally got it. Before he gets done with understanding what it means to work and to look at it. So let's go back and look at what we talked about just a minute. And then we'll kind of take a slightly the other route, and then we'll be wrapped up. So, work can be perverted. Even though we were designed for work, it can be perverted. It can be perverted by attitude, by pride, by love of riches, by idolatry, or just simply by the people we work with and making our relationships and our fellowship with them too important. It can take over our lives so that we neglect our home and have all kinds of negative consequences. But it's right when we work out of loving the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, which is what we're called to do anyway. When we see it as a service and take joy in serving our community, serving our nation, serving our fellow Christians, serving people who are hurting, serving people who need what we're doing. And it's also a joy when we see the fact that this really is a gift of God and what He made us for. We get it in perspective, and work becomes what we're called to do and a blessing.